Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for your support. Back on a chilly winter's night in 2005, Craig Johnson came to the Tattered Cover to introduce us to Walt Longmire. And while the crowd outnumbered the entire population of his hometown of U-Cross, Wyoming, it wasn't by much. But Craig is such a fantastic writer and a great guy to boot that even then we knew his day would come. Now, he is a best-selling author all over the world, and his books are the basis for the hit TV series Longmire. And we couldn't be happier for Craig. We are delighted and honored that Craig remembers his friends from way back when and continues to come and visit us every time a new Longmire mystery comes out, and we're thrilled that he's with us tonight to introduce us to the ninth installment in the series, A Serpent's Tooth. Would you please join me in congratulating Craig upon its publication?
You are overly kind. Thank you. Thank Charles, too, like that. We've been over in Colfax, so we haven't seen Charles in about 5 years. You know, I didn't know what had happened to him. I didn't know that, you know, that successful booksellers go over to Lodo to die. Like, that's what they do. So, it's kind of nice to find him again, for gosh sakes. That's so good to be back in the right time zone, I got to tell you. We've been on the road since, Memorial Day, like, is that what it was? Like, I think we took off a little before that, like that. But it's 63 events all in all. Like that. And so I'm just rapidly approaching the halfway mark right now is what's going on. Like that. But you know what? I always laugh like that because I was somewhere and I was signing books for somebody and they were like, I'm just so sorry you have to sign all these books. And I said, you know, I've had real jobs before. You know? And this isn't anything at all like them, let me tell you. Like, you know. We were doing the we did the National Book Festival in D.C. one time, like that is a few years back, and it was really wonderful. And did it with Margaret Cole, like at my good friend Margaret. And we were we finished up with this one event, and they shuttle us out of this reception that they had at the. At the Library of Congress, like that, and they put us in these limousines, and they were taking us away to these big 5-star hotels where they were putting us and all this, and everybody was just talking about how wonderful it was. Like, and this one big name author jumps in the back of the limousine with us, and I will not reveal his name. Well, maybe later. Like, but but he jumps in the back of the limo with us and says, I am absolutely exhausted. I have been signing and talking to people all day long. And I start leaning forward. My wife, Judy, puts her hand on my arm because she knows I'm going to say something really inappropriate. And I lean into this guy and I go, you never had a real job before, have you? I don't think I'm going to get a blurb from him anytime soon. Look at him. It's been a weird year. Like, it's been kind of wild. Like, I think I told this story last year in Colfax. Like, but I think it's probably the best description as to what my life has been like. Last year, when we started the tour with As the Crow Flies, we took off from the Buffalo Bill Center for the West, and I found an acronym that fits so you can remember that Center for the West. It's CAL is all you have to remember. Like, and they really don't appreciate me coming up with that. Like that. And so, but anyway, we took off out of there and we were heading up to Billings to jump on a plane because in northern Wyoming, we don't have real planes. Like we have planes, but what they do is they hand you the leather helmet and the goggles and say, back up, you know, whenever the prop starts, you know. And so we're heading up to Billings to jump on a plane like that. And I'm getting hungry. And it's kind of like, my wife knows I'm kind of like a trained bear, you know, that if I get hungry, bad things are probably going to happen, you know. And so she knows, you know, keep me fed. So we stop at this little cafe on the outskirts of Red Lodge. Like, we stop, get something to eat, and we're in that little cafe. As I'm looking around, I'm actually noticing a couple of the Absaroka County Sheriff's Department ball caps. As a matter of fact, here, would you hold your hat up? So everybody could take a look and see that. It's pretty snappy, aren't they? And if you didn't know there was no 24th county in Wyoming, you might think that that was the real deal now, wouldn't you? I was sitting there and I was writing a check for lunch after we got finished. And when I'm not wearing one of these, I'm wearing one of those. So I had one of those on and I'm writing a check, which kind of gives you an indication of what the place is like. You can still write a check for lunch. So I'm writing the check. And the woman across from the counter that owns the place, she looks at me and she goes, "Where'd you get that hat?" And she said it real aggressive like that. And I thought, oh, man, she thinks I'm a real sheriff's deputy and there's a problem. I thought somebody's dined and ditched, and I've got to go chase somebody down Main Street in Red Lodge. And I looked at her and I pointed at my head and I said, "It's not a real county." And she goes, "The hell it's not. It's Walt Longmire's county." I felt like I'd been smacked. And I looked at her and I said, "Well, I'm Craig Johnson." And she goes, "So?" And I said, "Well, I'm the one that writes the books." And she goes, "What books?" And all I can think of was, this is getting worse and worse and worse. And I said, "Well, the books that the TV show is based off of." And she goes, "There are books?" And I told Viking Penguin, I told him, I said, "Well, what we need to do is we need to, that should be the blurb, for the entire series. Whenever we have a stack of the books on an end cap or something, it should be, 'Yes, there are books,' So we'll see if they go for that or not. So far, they haven't. But in other exciting news, it's been a little weird like that. But when I started off the tour this year, we actually started off down in Santa Fe where they were doing the filming for Longmire, and we happened to be there and we were doing an event at Collected Works there on the plaza, and I get up there and I start doing the event, and I'm looking out in the audience and I see Adam Bartley, the guy that plays the Ferg on the TV show, and I was like, "Adam, come on up. You got to come on up." So Adam came up and we started doing the event. I look over and I see Cassidy Freeman, who plays Katie in the TV show. And I said, "Katie, come on up, come on, you got to come on up." And I look back and I see Lou Diamond Phillips in the back of the house. And I was like, "Come on up, come on up." Pretty soon we had the whole cast up there. The only one that was missing was Robert Taylor. And the reason he was missing was because he was filming that night. A lot of times they film all the way up into the middle of the night. It's kind of crazy because according to whatever, episode they happen to be filming So I'm standing there, and we're talking and everything, and we're all giving our, what it's like, to deal with these characters and all this. And all of a sudden, the crowd starts really going crazy, and screaming and all this kind of stuff. And I'm looking at them thinking, "What in the heck? What did I just say? I got to remember what I just said because it was evidently really good." And all of a sudden, I'm looking behind me and I look and there's a glass wall behind me. And the red and white Absaroka County Sheriff's Department Bronco had pulled up right there behind us. And the window was rolled down and Robert Taylor was doing this. To everybody that was in there in the bookstore, and everybody said, "Ah!" So then he pulls out, and I turn back around to the audience and I said, "It's Walt Longmire's toughest case, trying to find parking in Santa Fe." And about 5 minutes later, he comes strolling in, in costume and everything, and came in and the whole cast, signed books for everybody, that whole evening, which I thought was pretty wonderful. And it kind of gives you an indication as to what they're really like. They're pretty wonderful folks. I don't know if all, casts and, in these types of shows and everything are as accommodating as these folks are, but they really, really are. The other one that happened was kind of strange was in Los Angeles. I was doing an event at a place called Books Soup, and it's a little bookstore right there on Sunset Boulevard. It's right at about 9000 Sunset Boulevard. And what was really strange was I was sitting there trying to read from my book, and right beside me there was a 22 and a half story billboard of Walt Longmire, looking down at me, and I kept kind of looking, this, and then and finally I looked at everybody and I was like, he used to fit in my head, but not so much anymore, so. Well, this is actually the ninth in the Walt Longmire series. As I say, it always sounds strange coming out of my mouth, because those of you who know my books know that when I wrote The Cold Dish, it was really supposed to be a standalone book. And that's when Catherine Court, the president of Penguin USA, sat me down in New York and had the advanced reader copy of The Cold Dish sitting between us. And she said, "We would like some more of these." And I said, "Well, I'm happy to write you guys some more books." And she goes, "No, I don't think you understand. We would like some more of these." And she said, "We think these characters, this place, you know, these relationships, all of this, you know, people are going to want more of this. We think it's got legs. And that's when I, with the knowledge of not even having had one book published, started arguing with the president of Penguin USA, going, oh, I don't think that'll work. I don't think it's a good idea. But I got some other ideas I want to bounce off of you. And she said, why don't you go back to your ranch in Wyoming and sit down and think about this? Like that. And fortunately, I did, like that, because the big question was, were there more stories? You know, were there more stories to tell? Like that. And it came roaring back that, yeah, there were more stories to tell. And the other reason why I thought that there might be more books was is that one of the dirty little secrets about my books, that it's really maybe not so much of a secret, is that just about every single one of the storylines and the plots in my books tend to come from little newspaper articles up in Wyoming and Montana. Like, at all, you know, I've got my own little clipping service that I go around, and everywhere I go, I pick up these little newspapers, and I'll find a story, and I'll think, you know what, that might be a good Walt Longmire story. Like, and I'll cut it out, you know, and save it and put it away. And this one's no different. This one actually isn't any different. It actually came from a newspaper article over in Rapid City. Like that I don't know if you guys remember or not, but there was a Warren Jeffs, one of those fundamentalist polygamy groups over in Custer County, over near Custer. And you know, and they said that they were peaceable and those weren't gun towers, but they had towers and they had guys with guns in them. And that means they're gun towers in my book, like that. But anyway, they had that, and so anyway, they kind of broke that group down. But one of the things that was happening as a side effect to this group being there, the splinter group, was that 13- and 14-year-old boys were turning up in places like Rapid City, Gillette, Moorcroft, and they were the lost boys, was what they were. Like, at these 13- and 14-year-old boys, they'd get kicked out of these compounds on these trumped-up religious charges just to get rid of them so that the older men can have access to more and, you know, younger wives. And as hideous as that situation was, like, and I started thinking about it, and I thought, okay, well, what would Walt do if one of these young men were to turn up, you know, in Absaroka County? How would he deal with it? And what basically starts out as a kind of a social case rapidly builds itself into a criminal case when we discover that this young man who turns up in Walt's County, his advocate, his mother, has turned up missing, and nobody seems to be coming forward with any straight answers as to where she might be or what might have happened to her. And that's when it comes under the purview of Sheriff Walt Longmire. This is a treat for everybody because you get to see me do this. Mm-hmm. If I flip over backwards, it's because I couldn't see what I was looking at. So. Anyway, like, the title for the book actually comes from King Lear, Act 1, Scene 4, How Sharper Than a Serpent's Tooth It Is to Have a Thankless Child. And that's kind of what the book is about, thankless children, or what are perceived as thankless children. I'm going to read you just a little bit here from the beginning. I'm not going to read you the whole book because I think you can do that at home. So I'm going to read you a little bit from Chapter 1. I stared at the black and orange corsage on Barbara Thomas's lapel so that I wouldn't have to look at anything else. I don't like funerals, and a while ago I just stopped going to them. I think the ceremony is a form of denial, and when my wife died and my daughter Katie informed me that she was unaware of any instance where going to somebody's funeral ever brought them back, I just about gave it up. Mrs. Thomas had been the homecoming queen when Truman made sure that the buck stopped with him, which explained the somewhat garish ornamentation pinned on her prim and proper beige suit. Next week was the big game between the Durant Dogies and their arch rival, the Warland Warriors, and the whole town was black and orange crazy. The only thing worse than going to the funeral of someone you know is going to the funeral of someone you didn't. You get to stand there and be told about somebody you never met, and all I ever feel is that I might have missed my chance. I'd missed my chance with Dulcie Merriweather, who'd been one of Durant's fine and upstanding women. After all, I'm the sheriff of Absaroka County, so the fine and upstanding often live and pass beyond my notice. On a fine October afternoon, I leaned against the railing leading to the First Methodist Church, not so much to praise Dulcie Merriweather or to bury her, but more to talk about angels. I reached out and straightened Barbara Thomas's corsage. One of the jobs of an elected official in Wyoming is to understand one's constituency. Listen to people. Help them with their problems. Even when they're batshit crazy. I was listening to Barbara tell me about the angels who were currently assisting her with home repair, which I took as proof that she had passed the entrance exam to that particular belfry. I glanced at Mike Thomas, who had asked me to bushwhack his aunt on this early High Plains afternoon. He wanted me to talk to her and figured the only way that he could arrange running into me was by having me stand outside the church and wait for the two of them as they departed for a late lunch after service. I was trying to not look at the other person leaning on the railing with me, my undersheriff, Victoria Moretti, who, although she was trying to work off a hangover from too much revelry at the Basque Festival Bacchanal the night before, had decided to take advantage of my being in town on a Sunday. The only person left to look at was Barbara, 82 years old, platinum hair coiffed to perfection, and evidently mad as a hatter. So when did the angels pitch in and start working around your place, Mrs. Thomas? Call me Barbara, Walter. She nodded her head earnestly, as if she didn't want us to think that she was crazy. As Vic would say, good luck with that. About 2 weeks ago, I made a little list, and suddenly the railing on the front porch was fixed. She leveled a malevolent glance at the well-dressed cowboy in the navy blazer and tie to my left, her youngest nephew. It's difficult to get things done around home since Michael lives so far away. As near as I could remember, Mike's studio sculpture was right at the edge of town, and I knew he only lived about 2 miles away, but that was between the two of them. I adjusted the collar of my flannel shirt, enjoying the fact that I wasn't in uniform today, figuring it was going to be the extent of my daily pleasures. So the angels came and fixed the railing? Yes. Anything else? She nodded again enthusiastically. Lots of things. They unclogged my gutters, rehung the screen door on the back porch, and fixed the roof on the pump house. Vic sighed. Jesus, you want to send them over to my place? I ignored my undersheriff, which was a difficult thing to do. She was wearing a summer dress in an attempt to forestall the season, and a marvelous portion of her tanned legs was revealed above her boots and below the hem. Have you ever actually seen the angels, Mrs. Thomas? Barbara, please. She shook her head, indulging my lack of knowledge of all things celestial. They don't work that way. So how do they work? She placed the palms of her hands together and leaned forward. I make my little list, and the things just get done. It's a sign of divine providence. Vic mumbled under her breath. It's a sign of divine senility. Barbara Thomas continued without a breaking stride. I have a notebook where I have a number of things that have to be done in order of importance. Then I leave it on the room divider, and presto. She leaned back and beamed at me. He works in mysterious ways. She paused for a moment to glance at the church looming over my shoulder, and then altered the subject. You used to go to services here, didn't you, Walter? Yes, ma'am. I used to accompany my late wife. But you haven't been since she passed away? I took a deep breath to relieve the tightness in my chest, the way I always did whenever anybody brought up the subject of Martha. No, ma'am. We had an agreement where she would take care of the next world if I took care of this one. I glanced at Mike as he smoothed his mustache and tried not to smile, and there seems to be enough to hold my attention around here as of late. I returned my eyes back to her. So you haven't seen them? Seen who? The holy handyman, for Christ's sake. Barbara looked annoyed. Young lady, you need to watch your language. I drew Barbara's attention away from a sure-shot head-on verbal train wreck. So you haven't actually seen the angels, then? No. She thought about it and stared at the cracks in the sidewalk, the strands of buffalo grass, having abandoned all hopes of pushing through. They do take some food out of the icebox every now and again. I kept my eye on her. Food. Yes, she thought about it some more. And they sometimes take a shower. A shower? She was nodding again. But they always clean up after themselves. I just noticed because the towels are damp or there are a few pieces of fried chicken missing. I shot Mike a look, but he was busy studying the banks of Clear Creek on the other side of the gravel walk a little ways away, probably checking for trout and wishing that he were somewhere else. My eyes tracked back to the elderly woman. Fried chicken. Yes, it would appear the angels really like Chester's fried chicken. I leaned back on the railing and watched the dancing pattern of light in the water for a while myself, the scattered and upturned golden leaves of the aspens spinning like a lost flotilla. I see. And Oreos. The angels like double-stuffed Oreos, too. Anything else? Werner's Diet Ginger Ale. You must be running up quite a grocery bill feeding the legions. I smiled and chose my next words carefully. Barbara, when these things happen, I mean, do you make your list and then go to bed and then get up and everything is repaired? Oh, no, I do my agenda in the mornings, and then I go out to run my errands or do my bridge club, and then I get back, everything is done. In the morning? Well, by the middle of the afternoon, yes. I pulled out my pocket watch and looked at it, noticing it was 10 after 1. So, if I were to head over to your place right now, it's likely that I might catch the angels at their labors? She looked a little worried. I suppose. What is it you've got them doing today? She thought. There's a leak in the trap under the kitchen sink. Vic could barely hold her peace. Wait, angels work on Saturdays and Sundays too? I looked at the nice but crazy lady. Where do they get the parts on a Sunday? Buell Hardware is closed. Her eyes narrowed. I get them the supplies, Walter. The Lord provides, but I don't think that it extends to plumbing parts. I stood up and looked. She looked concerned. Where are you going? Well, I think I'll drive by your place while you and Mike have a lunch. I shrugged. Maybe I'll see if I can get Vic here a little divine guidance. Barbara Thomas folded her hands like broken-winged birds and spoke in a quiet voice. I'd rather you didn't, Walter. I waited a moment, then asked, why is that? She paused, just a little petulant, and then looked up at me with damp eyes. They do good works, and you shouldn't interrupt good works. Thank you. Well, as you might well imagine, it is not angels that are doing the work over at Barbara Thomas's house. Like that turns out to be one of these lost boys. Like, and I was actually kind of pleased also when Darren Welch's design for this one showed up. I really love the covers for the books, and I always like to say something nice about Darren. This one's, you know, optic orange like that. But if you look here in the back, you can actually see the rock formation of the Teapot Dome. Which plays a significant part in the storyline as it goes forward. Look at, the only thing that kind of disconcerted me a little bit was when I saw the blue-eyed rattlesnake here intertwined as along the roadside cross. And I told Darren that, look at, and I said, you know, I've never seen a blue-eyed rattlesnake before, but since we've been on tour, there have been a number of ladies who've told me that they used to date him. Look at, so, you know. So. Anyway, at this point, what I'd like to do is open up and let you guys ask some questions. I haven't been down in a while, so I thought you might have some questions for me. And I'm supposed to repeat the questions, so remind me to do that as they're recording our audio here tonight. Yes, ma'am.
Are you always on set when they're filming?
Am I always on set when they're filming? No, thank goodness, because they film for 5 months. And it has all of the attraction of being in the Army. It really does. It's like, you know, it's kind of like watching paint dry for 5 months. Like, that is what it's like. They, you know, it's pretty interesting like that because they work, you know, pretty rough schedules. I mean, they do work from very early in the mornings till very late at night. And it's, you know, if you're not involved, you know, really involved with what it is that's going on, if you're just standing back there watching it happen, you know, it gets kind of boring, I have to admit. You know, what I'm more help with than anything else is they've got, you know, a writer's room down there at Warner, and what they do is they send me synopses, you know, of each one of the episodes, and then I give them feedback on that, you know, and let them know if there's any major problems with the storyline like that, and then they send me the actual script, and then I go through the script and, you know, fix certain things, like, you know, it leads to me getting, like, you know, texts, you know, at 3:30 in the middle of the night that say, which way does the Powder River flow? You know, north or south? Okay, you know, things like that, you know, and little things like that I have to kind of correct as I go along. Okay, but yes, sir. You know, who was my original inspiration for Walt Longmire? It was one of those things where it really was. Very rarely do you find somebody who's a perfect fit, you know, for a character that you need. Most generally, what you end up doing is doing kind of a Dr. Frankenstein thing, where you take bits and pieces, you know, from different people and kind of stitch them all together to make the character that you need to tell the story that you want to tell. You know, but still, one of my favorite quotes is from Wallace Stegner at the beginning of fiction and of writing and teaching fiction, like that, where he says that the biggest piece of fiction ever written is that disclaimer that's at the beginning of every novel that says nobody in this book is based off of anybody alive or dead, you know, and so, you know, I do tend to, you know, I use a lot of people I meet, a lot of people are my friends, a lot of people that are my family. Like, I mean, my dad is Lucian Connolly, the old sheriff that Walt goes and plays chess with on Tuesday nights. You know, that's my dad, you know, to a T. You know, and all kinds. I mean, there's some of them actually sitting here. You know, poor Michael Crutchley is sitting back here in the back corner over here. He's in the book. So there are actually a number of different people that are in the book, you know, that are here right now. Like, and Nancy's here. Like, she's in the book. So, you know, I can go through and, like, pick out different people here in the house and tell you, you know, which characters they play. Like, so I want to warn you that if you come up here to get your book signed and you stall out for more than 30 seconds talking to me, you're taking your literary life in your hands, you know, just so you know. Look at, because if I find you interesting, you may end up in a book somewhere down the road, just so you know. Yes, ma'am.
I'm new to you. Is this your first hardcover book?
No. All the 9 books. This is the 9th in the series. Like, but the Cold Dish was it was in hardback. All of them have been in hardback all the way down the line. So, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
Is there a Henry Standing Bear in your life?
life.
You know, the guy that I based an awful lot of Henry off of is a fellow by the name of Marcus Red Thunder, who's Northern Cheyenne. Like, and a lot of what I got off of him is a kind of quirky sense of humor that he's got. You know, it's pretty striking to me, you know, the Northern Cheyenne sense of humor. I mean, I've never seen a group of individuals that have been more maligned as not having a sense of humor than, you know, than Indians. Like, I do say Indians, I don't say Native Americans, because all my Indian friends make fun of me when I try and be politically correct. They always look at me and go, "Where are you born?" And I go, "I was born in America." So you would be a Native American too then, wouldn't you? So but that's, you know, the Indians that I know have incredible senses of humor like that. And Marcus is like really got a great sense of humor, but it's also, he has this kind of quirky attitude a little bit. And one of my favorite stories like that I haven't told all that much is one where Lou Diamond Phillips, when he got the role of Henry, at 2 weeks after he got the role, he jumped on a plane at LAX like that and on his own dime and flew up to Billings like that and got off the plane and jumped in the truck with Marcus like that. And he was going down to the Northern Cheyenne Reservation to do gifting ceremony. Sweat lodge ceremonies, tribal elder ceremonies, and all this. And so when he got off the plane, like that, they got down to where the baggage handling was, like that, and Marcus looked at the baggage handler guy and said, "Lou, go ahead and grab your bag. You know, thanks, Mike. You know, appreciate it." Like that, and they loaded it up. Like that, and, you know, and he was like, "Guy, he knows the baggage handler. That's pretty cool." Like that, and so they drive down like that, you know, and they go in. They stop in to get gas in the truck. Like that, and they go in, and the guy at the gas station's there, and you know, he says, "Hey, Steve," like that, you know, "here's how much gas we got." Gives him the credit card. He pays for it, and they leave. Like that, and he knows the guy at the gas station too. Well, it must be where he goes to get gas. So then they drove down to one of the, you know, the discount store to pick up some blankets and all these different stuff, you know, for the gifting ceremonies at the powwow. And, you know, he walks in like that, and you know, there's a girl in the high aisle way like it. He says, "Hey, Shirley, can you tell us, you know, where, you know, the small appliances would be?" Like it, and she did like it. And finally, you know, I guess Lou looks at him and he goes, "Do you know everybody in Billings, Montana?" And Marcus turns and looks at him and says, "Everybody with a name tag, yeah." Quintessential Henry, you know, when you get right down to it, you know, because they're looking for the strange, exotic, mystical, spiritual, you know, native thing there. No, they had a name tag. So, yes, sir.
I've been to the Indian market in Santa Fe, and it's really interesting because they're like, if they're Pueblos, it's all yes, no. Mm-hmm. If they're Cheyenne or anything else, you're talking to a fully brushed sailor.
They're quite capable of conversation once they get the prime. Once you prime the pump, look at, they really kind of take off and run with it there too. So, yes, sir.
Do you share any of Welsh Native American spirituality?
Yeah. Yeah, I do. Do I share any of Walt Longmire's native spirituality? Yeah, I do. I take a great deal of credence in the natural world. I think the natural world gives us an awful lot of signs like that. But the problem is that in the modern world, we're constantly in a rush, like at, and trying to push ourselves. You know, and we don't see those signs. We don't pay attention the way that we should. And you know, hang around with my Cheyenne and Crow buddies, like it kind of makes me slow down and makes me see the things that maybe I should. To give you an indication. Like that, one of the things that had happened was is that when on the first day that they were filming Longmire at the caldera up above Taos, like at, it's way up in this, you know, this caldera that's really high altitude, look at, and Walt's, you know, cabin is an old Forest Service cabin that's up there, and they were getting ready to film on the first day, and it was the scene that takes place between Katie and Walt on the front porch, and they got ready to start the cameras, and all of a sudden 150 head of elk moved out of the tree line right down in front of Walt's cabin. And Chris Chulak, the director, said, "Get Robert in the Bronco driving through the elk." And so it made it. It's in the pilot. You see, you know, Robert driving, you know, Walt driving through the, you know, 150 head of elk. And what I love is he treats it like it's morning traffic. He acts like he's on the 95 or, you know, the 25 or something like that, because he's just driving through these elk, and he's like, "God damn elk every morning," like that same thing. You know, he doesn't even look at them or anything, you know. Like, and, you know, there, and I took that as a sign that, yeah, maybe this might work. You know, maybe this TV show is going to go after all. You never can tell. And it actually did. Like, we became the highest rated scripted drama in A&E's network history, which is kind of nice. Like, and which is not bad for a show that takes place in the least populated county in the least populated state in America. You know, it's kind of anti-CSI when you get right down to it. You know, And then I'll give you another quick indication of one of these things that happened to me. It was a couple years back, I was loading wood into the wood-burning stove in the front of the house at the ranch, and it was getting late, and it was a full moon that night, and my wife looked out the window, Judy did, and she goes, "Oh, my," and I looked, and we've got the splines of a teepee, up on the, in the north pasture, and up in the splines, up on the top poles was this big great horned owl. I mean, the biggest great horned owl I'd ever seen in my entire life, perfectly silhouetted in this full moon. And I look up and I saw that, and I turned around to Judy, and according to Northern Cheyenne, of course, they are messengers from the camp of the dead. They bring messages back and forth. And I turned around to Judy, and I was just kind of joking, and I said, "Well, I guess somebody's trying to send us a message." And so I got up the next morning, the first email that came in was one from Ann Hillerman that said that Tony Hillerman had died that night. And I was like, huh. So every time I start to be smart, I just tell myself to have a steaming cup of shut the hell up. So. Yes, ma'am. Not really. I mean, it's difficult for them, because they read the books, and then they're doing the TV scripts, so it's kind of schizophrenic for them, because, they'll read something like, "Wait, no, that doesn't happen," in our world, So it's kind of tough for them, But have the actors had an effect on the way that I write the books? Probably not, in the sense that, I was writing the books 7 years before Hollywood found me, and I'll be writing the books after Hollywood leaves me, And so, and like I said, majority of the characters are all based off of people I know or bits and pieces of people that I know, and these are my friends and my neighbors, and family and all of that, and the impact that they have on me has, been lifelong, and so, I probably see them more than, I do the actors or actresses. Not that they're not doing an absolutely magnificent job. I'm very pleased with what it is that they're doing, I have to admit.
I think I'm asking that partly because I know that when I read a book after I've seen the movie or
Oh, it's an incredibly powerful medium. I mean, there are a lot of authors that won't, even see, the Hollywood versions of their work simply because they don't want to be, hidebound by what it is that they see. It's a very, very powerful medium. But, what's nice is that they've kind of we had an agreement that they'll kind of go in some different directions, than what I've done with the books. One of the things that they did that I thought was very smart right from the get-go was they said, whenever we borrow any plot lines or anything from the books, we're going to change the ending. And the reason they do that is so that if you're watching the television show, it won't ruin the books. If you're reading the books, it won't ruin the television show. And I'll let you in on a dirty little secret. One of their favorite things to have happen is whenever somebody, if a husband and wife are watching, one turns to the other and said, "Oh, I read this book. It's so-and-so that did it." And then you get to the end of the TV show and it's not the person they told you. So they really like that. They really enjoy that. So, yes, sir.
In that vein, how do you feel about the story line of the series with Walt's wife?
Well, what you have to remember, as far as the storyline with Walt's life being different, from the one that's in the books, they started a little bit further back. It's only been a year since Walt's wife died in the television show. In my books, it's 5 years later. So there's a little bit of difference right there. And so, dealing with the aftermath of that, is a little bit more concurrent, with what it is that they're trying to do. But everything that they do has an awful lot to do with dramatic conflict. They really, need to have a lot of dramatic conflict, in the shows. And it's a little bit different also because they've got 42 minutes to tell a story. So they really kind of have to front load all of that dramatic conflict right off the bat. I can kind of ease you into that dramatic conflict for a couple of hundred pages or so. But they can't. They got to hit the ground running, which makes it a little bit tough. It is a different world because they've got 42 minutes to tell a story. They don't have 42 minutes and 20 seconds. They got 42 minutes. And what's really gut wrenching for me sometimes also is that I see the scripts ahead of time and I go through them how many of you saw the first episode this of this season? See, that's why we're a success right there. So In that first episode, which was based a lot of the plot was taken from Hell is Empty, the seventh book. And I got to admit, the first thing they said, we're really wanting to use Hell is Empty as the opening episode for the second season. And then they said, but don't ask for Virgil, because we have enough trouble finding Indian actors without trying to find one that's 7'2". So that was that. Gone. But then again, they had the 42-minute thing to try and get it through. And I thought one of the wonderful things that they did was that they were able to recap a lot of the main plot points of a previous season in one episode without saying, last year on Longmire. And so I was impressed by that. When I was reading the script, what was interesting for me was, I read the script, in the beginning part, I'll give you some little bits that were actually kicked, were cut, from the script. In the opening bit where the Bronco pulls up and the buffalo's out there on the road and they stop, what happens in the original script is Vic jumps out of the Bronco is what happens, and Walt is lunging for her, trying to get a hold of her, and she says, I've shooed cows before. Now, those of us of the West know that buffalo don't shoo. Well, it chases her all the way around the Bronco, and she dives in the open door, and then the buffalo hits the door, redenting the door that Walt just got fixed, which is very Wyoming, And so, Walt looks over at her and says, never get out of the truck, which I thought was really wonderful. Too long, cut, gone. Had to cut it out. Later on, there's the episode, the sequence, there's a scene where Branch and Henry are, going riding up into the Cloud Peak Wilderness area on horseback, and there's a part where Henry turns around and says something to Branch, and Branch looks at him and says, what is it with you anyway? What is it with you and no contractions? What's that all about anyway? And Henry turns around and looks at him and says, why are you in such a hurry? what a wonderful, sequence of dialogue. It was just so telling about both of those characters. Too long, cut, gone. At the end, whenever Walt and the convict have beaten each other to a pulp and neither one of them can even raise an arm to either attack or defend, and Walt's laying there against that tree stump, and he's looking at the guy, he's laying out there in the snow, and they're looking at each other, and he says, I beat you to a standstill, Walt Longmire. And Walt says, yeah, and it might be the last thing you ever do. And he looks at him and says, what do you mean by that? And he says, well, I'm not in any condition to come out there and hurt you, but I ain't in any condition to come help you either. I'm wearing a sheepskin coat and a wool hat. You're in an orange jumpsuit. When they find us in the morning, who do you think will still be alive? It was kind of a cold series of dialogue like that, but too long, cut, gone. So it's a little wrenching like that to see, what stuff goes in and then what stuff has to come out, but it's, it's 42 minutes, so you have to do it their way. Yes, ma'am. I would love to have them do that. I would love to have them do that.
That means we're never going to see the beginning of Junkyard
Dogs? Not necessarily. They really, really like the beginning of Junkyard Dogs. they really love the beginning of that book, with the old guy tied to the back of 100, you put a nylon rope to the Oldsmobile, which is a true story. That's a true story that I got. That one, and then how many of you guys have read Messenger, the little e-special that's the connector tissue? One of the little elongated short stories is called Messenger, and it's actually a fundraiser for the Poo Poo Project at the Teton Raptor Center, which is what they do is they put screens on the top of vent caps in bathrooms in state and national forests to keep boreal owls from going down in there and getting trapped in the vaults below. But in it, what they discover is there's an owl, an adolescent, owl stuck down in this toilet in this short story. And basically what happens is that Henry relays the fact that if it's an adolescent owl, it might be a name-carrying owl from the other world to an yet unborn child. Well, as we know, Katie's pregnant, so Walt's granddaughter is about to be born, and this owl may be carrying the name, so they have to get this owl out of this toilet. They have to. Well, Walt and Henry are of a certain girth, so that they won't fit, down into the toilet, but Vic will. And Lou Diamond Phillips wants to film that so bad it's about to kill him. And I'm not sure if it's because he thinks it's a really funny scene or he wants to stick Katie Sackhoff in a porta potty. I'm not sure. We'll have to wait and see what happens with that. So, anybody else? Somebody else had their hands up, but I've been ignoring folks. I'm sorry. Yeah. You know, a lot of the humor is very subtle, you know, in the reactions and the takes, you know. But one of the difficulties is, it's kind of like telling in this little sequence that I just read, one of the difficulties is an awful lot of the humor of the books is Walt. You know, it's because you're in Walt's head and you're seeing Walt's observations and Walt's thinking and all of that, and it's very difficult to do that. I mean, when they originally did the pilot episode, they had a voiceover and you were hearing, you know, Walt thinking as the show went on, but it really didn't work. You got really tired of it, even with a wonderful voice like Robert Taylor has. You know, you just got really tired of it really quick, and you know, it was constantly Walt explaining and Walt telling and all this. And so I think they decided that they would much rather rely on the actors to try and convey as much as they could. So a certain amount of that humor, you know, gets lost. But then again, it also goes back to that aspect of the chronology of it, like that. You know, by the time we meet Walt in the first book, The Cold Dish, he's pretty clinically depressed, you know, when we meet him, but it's even worse 4 years ago, like that. So, you know, we're kind of seeing him start to come out of, you know, this clinical depression as the season goes on, especially with this particular season. I have to say, there are some shockers ahead. So, you know, and that's all. I'm contractually obligated to not tell you anything more than that. Like that, so, you know. Or else the Warner Brothers helicopter lands on top of the tattered cover and hauls me away. Like, you know, you'll never hear from me again. So it would be horrifying. So, yes, ma'am.
I wanted to tell you how much I've enjoyed your book. And when I read Another Man's Moccasins, that was very telling. But you're not old enough to have been in Vietnam. So I wondered where you came up with your history for that story.
I actually had a brother who was. And an awful lot of the telltale information that I had, you know, came from him. Okay, and it was a very interesting book to write, simply because it gave us an opportunity to talk about those things, like long afterward. And but you're not alone in that. I have to say, quite honestly, I did a book club for Camp Lejeune, and they had like about 200, you know, guys, like you know, and about a dozen, you know, officers, and they got to the point, you know, and it was a phone thing, so they couldn't see what I looked like. So it was a phone talk thing. And so I finished up talking with him. And, you know, the one of the captains that was there, he said, "Okay, well, now which unit were you with in the Marines, like in Vietnam?" And I said, "Well, I actually wasn't there." Like, you know, and I explained, like, and he goes, "Crap." He says, "We got about three guys that think they served with you." Like, so. So. I felt pretty confident after that. I was like, "Yeah, I was there." Actually, with my brother, one of my brother's favorite jokes, I finally got to use. I think it was in "As the Crow Flies," like that, where he says, "How many Vietnam vets does it take to change a light bulb?" "You don't know? That's right, because you weren't there, man." He loves that joke. Yes, sir. Yeah, you know, but we're in a bookstore, you know. Let's see, does it bother me or does it rankle me in any way, you know, the TV show? I have to be honest and say no. I really have to be honest and say no. I'm having the time of my life. It's really kind of wonderful. And the effect, you know, that it has. I mean, to be honest with you, I mean, I'm not moving to L.A. to become a screenwriter, and I'm not moving to New York or anything like that. I'm a cowboy writer in U-Cross, Wyoming, population 25, and when I die, that's when I'll be going somewhere else. And so... So it's not like it's been life-changing as far as that kind of thing is concerned, but the effect that it's had, you know, on book sales, like getting the books in people's hands, has been kind of miraculous. I mean, you know, whenever Longmire started up about a year ago, like in that first season, The Cold Dish, a seven-year-old book, climbed up onto the New York Times bestsellers extended list 7 years after publication, which was pretty nice, like that, I got to admit, you know, so... Applaud yourselves. You're the guys that did the heavy lifting. Like, you know, but I have to admit, though, that the majority of the emails that I get nowadays start off with, "I'm really sorry I didn't know about you until I saw, you know, the A&E television series, you know, Longmire." And I'm always writing people back going, "That's okay." "It's all right. Just as long as we came together." Yes, sir.
Is there anything that you're not happy with about the TV show?
anything I'm not happy with about the TV show. Let's see. Well, everybody's too good looking. That's number one. And the main reason I say that is that, you know, they actually sent me the DVDs of the auditions, you know, for the roles, which was crazy, like that, because they just don't do that. Hollywood does not do that. Like, and I guess they wanted to see what I thought of the actors that they were considering, like that. And I got the one for Robert Taylor, and I had put it in, you know, in the kitchen, you know, put it in the DVD player, and my wife was sitting behind me, and I'm looking at him, and I'm thinking, you know, he's pretty good, you know, because, you know, A, he's like 6'4", like that. He's a big guy, like that. He's got, you know, really a lot of weathering on his face, so he looks like a Wyoming sheriff, a guy that's been out of doors most of his life. And you know, and the other thing was, is really great about what he did was, is that he's going into a woman's house, like, he's telling her that her husband is dead and he's not coming home. He doesn't know this woman. He's never been in her home before. He did something that none of the other actors did. He took off his hat. And I was like, that's our guy right there. You know, we didn't have to teach him basic civility. His mom did the job. Look at, and so and I was feeling really good about Robert Taylor at that point in time, but that's when my wife went, oh my. And I turn around and look at her, and she goes, he's handsome. As you might expect, there was a little pause there, like that. And then she said, he's kind of like a TV version of you, taller, better looking, with a better voice. So I don't like Robert Taylor all that much. Yes, ma'am.
I'm curious if you still consider writing books outside of Absarok County.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I've actually started a few, as a matter of fact. Like, I've actually got a couple that I've already started. I've got a literary fiction piece that I'm writing. Like, I've got a psychological thriller that I've started. So there are a couple I've already got on the burners already that I'm working on, like that. But then, you know, Walt just gets in the way, you know? And I say that, you know, in a nice way, like that, because, you know, it's just amazing how often my mind tends to trip back to Absaroka County. Like, that, it's you know, one of those things where it's a good group of folks, and Walt's a good guy to ride along with. Like, that, I have a good time with him. You know, he's insightful, he's funny, he's smart. You know, he's just good company. You know, and so I enjoy writing those books, I have to admit. We have a book coming out in October. For the first time ever, we've got two Walt books coming out in 1 year. If you want, I'll give you the lowdown on that. If you want, like, I can tell you about that. Okay, it was supposed to be a short story, and after like about 4 days, it was over 80 pages long. Okay, and so I wrote New York, and I said, this thing is 80 pages long. I don't think it's a short story anymore. And they said, well, how long do you think? I said, I think about halfway through. I think it's going to be about half the length of one of the books. And they said, well, we'll put it out as a hardback in October, like that. So I'm fully intent on being back down here in October, like that. So, you know, look for me then. But what happens in the book itself, like that, is it starts out like that. There's a woman that kind of, it's actually called The Spirit of Steamboat is what the book is called. And for those of you who don't know, the Steamboat is the bucking horse that's on all of the Wyoming license plates, like in the mascot for the state, which was originally, you know, was a really, you know, really wonderful and incredibly capable, hard to ride bucking horse, you know, in the rodeo turn of the century. And what happens is, it's called Spirit of Steamboat, but in the beginning of the book, what happens is a young woman comes into Walt's office, and she's carrying a garment bag, and she tells Ruby, she says, I'm looking for the sheriff of Absaroka County. So Ruby buzzes, you know, Walt, and Walt comes out, and she looks at Walt, and she goes, no, not you, older. Who was the sheriff before you? And Walt walks her over to the stairs, you know, in the old Carnegie Library, where the 8x10 photographs are all going up the steps, like that. And you get to see Walt's picture, which is the only one that's in color. And Walt, you know, has got this cheesy 70s mustache and sideburns, you know. And then right beside him is the picture of Lucian. And we get a more, you know, detailed description of what Lucian's, you know, picture looks like. And Lucian's got his open road Stetson on. He's got his Eisenhower jacket, you know, World War II Eisenhower jacket on. He's got his star pinned on the outside. And he's got his foot up on the, you know, on a chair. And he's got his hand draped back, pulling a jacket back, where he's got the web of his thumb resting on the .38. And then I think the way that, and he says he's got a, you know, eyebrow cocked like a Winchester, like that, and he says, you know, he looked perfectly capable of shooting the photographer if not happy with the results of the photograph, you know. And so she looks at him like that, and Walt says, well, there he is, you know, Lucian Connolly, the used to be the high sheriff of Absaroka County. And the young woman says, is he's dead? Like that, and Walt says, oh, no, he's still very much alive and still a big pain in all of our butts. Like that, and she says, well, I need to see him. And Walt says, well, maybe if you tell me what this is about, maybe I can help you. Look at, and she says, well, I have something I need to give back to him. And she hugs the garment bag a little bit closer. So it's Tuesday night, 2 days before Christmas. And Walt figures, well, what the heck? I'll just drive her over and let her meet Lucian, and they can figure this out. So he drives her over, takes her into the home for assisted living. Lucian meets her. She meets Lucian. She looks at him. She goes, you don't remember me either, do you? Lucian looks at her and says, young lady, I flew Mitchell B-25s off the deck of the USS Hornet in 1942. So there's an awful lot of water that's gone under the bridge. So maybe if you tell me what this is about or give me some kind of a clue as to what our connection is, maybe I can help you. She looks at him. She leans forward and she says only one word, steamboat. That's all she says. We jump back to 1988. And Walt Longmire is standing at the Durant Airport looking out the observation deck at a blizzard. And what's happened is there's been a – he's only been the sheriff for 2 months. Lucian's, you know, often retired down at the Euscotti Bar. And so, you know, Walt's trying to figure out what to do because there's a Flight for Life helicopter coming in. There's been a car wreck up on 9094. Three people are dead, and there's a child with 30% burns over her body and smoke inhalation damage. She has 4 hours to live. They've got to get her to Denver Children's Hospital or she will not survive. They're closing up all the highways. This Flight for Life helicopter in this blizzard is not going to make it. It's going to have to make an emergency landing in Durant. And Walt's trying to figure out what to do. So he walks over to the hangar manager, looks at him. He walks past all these Cessnas, you know, and Piper Cubs, and goes over to the manager and says, you know, will any of these things fly down to Denver in these kind of conditions? And the hangar manager says, not only no, Walt, but hell no. Look, it would be like trying to fly a box kite in a tornado. There's no way. And so Walt looks at the plane they're working on, and he says, well, what about this one? And the hangar manager says, you got to be kidding. It's an old slurry bomber from over in Graybull the Forest Service uses. You know, it's the hydraulics are shot. The electricals are gone. It's, you know, it's a multi-engine. Nobody's got the hours or the license to fly this thing. Like it. And Walt walks up to the front of the plane, and he looks, you know, at the nose of it. And on the nose of it, there's a bucking horse. And in script letters, it says steamboat across it. And he looks back at the hangar manager, and he says, why does this plane look familiar? And he says, well, it's old Mitchell B-25 from World War II. Look at it. And Walt turns around and says, I know somebody that can fly this. He goes down to the Euscotti Bar on Main Street, where Lucian Connolly is four bourbons down. Knocks that fourth bourbon out of Lucian's hand, grabs him by the shirt front, and says, come on, fly, boy. I got a plane you got to fly. And the whole story is about this epic flight that they make from Durant to Denver on Christmas Eve in 1988. So I think you'll enjoy it. It's a good little story. So.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.